Hello, is everybody doing?
Good. Good.
First question was, can you hear me? What's the first question? Can you everyone hear me?
Baruch Hashem.
Okay, good.
Baruch Hashem.
Question number one. Question number two is, how's everyone doing?
Good.
Baruch Hashem, same answer.
Okay, great. Very good. Recording. Okay, excellent. So let's continue on. We're on page 151 in your Stone Chumash. It's a Perek Chaf Tes in Sefer Bereishis. And I want to we left off last week. We were discussing the story of Yaakov marrying Rachel and Leah, the relationship, the marriage, and we'll continue on with that this week. So we left off last week, you know, based on my notes and my memory, we left off, it was at verse 19 or verse 20, really. So at verse 19, is where Lavan says, okay, Yaakov says, okay, I want to marry Rachel, your youngest daughter. Lavan says, okay, no, better she marry you than marry somebody else. And they made a deal that I'll work for 7 years in order to marry your daughter. That was the deal. We spoke about why 7 years, but that ultimately the idea was he wanted to work out some sort of deal with Lavan to marry Rachel because he had this desire, this love for Rachel, which we described was not a love of romance or lust, but a love for who she was and her potential to help build Klal Yisrael. So let's move to verse 20. So it says in verse 20, so Yaakov worked 7 years for Rachel, and this seemed to him a few days because of his love for her. So this verse is describing the 7 years. We have one line to describe 7 years passing. And that one line says that Yaakov worked for Rachel. So the Torah is very clear. Commentaries point out that it was clear to all who Yaakov was working for. We know at the end they'll be switched. Yaakov will be tricked. But everybody knew that Yaakov was working on behalf of Rachel. So that's why it says Yaakov worked for Rachel. Because it's stressing that. It was clear to all that that was the goal here. So Lavan shouldn't be able to pull a fast one and say, no, the work was actually for somebody else. It was for Leah. It was for money. It was clear it was for Rachel. In this 7 year period, even though it was 7 years, which was really a long time, I think 7 years ago, it was a long time ago. But those 7 years seem very, very quick in Yaakov's eyes because of his love of her. And just point out again, the love of her means he loved her for who she was. Again, it wasn't a matter of lust or a matter of attraction. It was a matter of her essence because she was somebody he felt he could build the Jewish people with. Now, this idea that went so fast is a famous question the commentaries point out. It said that it was only like a few days in his eyes. Now, we all know when we have some sort of goal, some sort of deadline, not a deadline, but a goal, you know, something exciting looking forward to, often it feels like it takes forever. You know, you have a vacation that you're waiting to go on. You have a simcha you're waiting to take part in. And that's going to be, you know, 4 months away. So often the wait feels like a very long time. You're waiting and waiting and waiting for the big day. That's typical human nature. But it says concerning Yaakov that when he waited to marry Rachel, the 7 years went by very, very fast. So commentaries are bothered by, what does that mean? That doesn't seem to be typical. Why did it go so fast? So the Malbim says one thing. The Malbim says very simply, he felt it was a bargain. Meaning 7 years for a woman like this, what a bargain. So that's why it went so fast for him. And he viewed it as a very, very short time. Now she's worth 50 years of work. You know, so 7 years I'm getting off easy. And that's why it seems so small to him. That's one way to understand it. But there's also a deeper approach to this. And let's understand a little bit of this, I guess, psychological phenomenon that we have, that when we have a goal we're waiting for, it feels like a long time. You know, you're supposed to go somewhere today at 5 o'clock. You're excited about it. It's 1:30. It takes forever to get to 5 o'clock. So why is it that way? So usually the reason things feel like they take forever is because all I'm doing is killing time until the big day. You know, it's not like every single day is being used productively to get me there. It's that I want to get to a certain time. Right now, I'm not there. So I have to kill time, as it were, to get to that point. So that feels like forever because there's no sense of accomplishment in the wait. The wait itself doesn't seem to give me any sort of, I'm not productive during that wait. I'm not building towards the moment. I'm just waiting for it. Now I'm going. You know, I want to go out tonight with my friends, and I'm excited about it. And it's 5 hours from now. Nothing I'm doing now is actually getting me to that point, besides killing the time. So if that's the case, it feels like forever. But on the other hand, if I feel a sense of accomplishment every single day in what I'm doing, that it's getting me to my goal, then it moves fast, because I feel that each day is valuable and precious and is part of the process. If you're building up something, if you're actually taking that time to, in a productive way, to get to your goal, then because you're not killing time, but you're using that time well, it actually moves much faster. All of us know when we're being productive, you look at your watch, say, wow, how did the time pass? You do that all the time. But we're having a slow day, it slips on and on and on. So the difference is that time being used in a productive way, building towards your goal? Or is that time used just waiting around for the goal to come? So when it comes to Yaakov, Yaakov understood it wasn't just a matter of waiting for that 7 years to pass. He understood I have to use each day to build myself towards my goal. Now, what does that mean? It means for Yaakov, he has to be ready to be married. He has to build up himself, build the relationship, and prepare himself to father the 12 tribes. So every day wasn't just I'm working on Lavan's farm, just waiting for the day I can get married, but it was a time where he was being productive within himself to be ready to become a father of Klal Yisrael. So therefore, each day went fast because he felt I'm accomplishing, I'm getting there, I'm building it up. So that's a big difference. So are you just killing that time, just trying to get to your goal? Or is it that you're using that time to build towards your goal? If you're building, the time goes fast. If you're killing time, the time goes slow. So for Yaakov, we know Yaakov was somebody who didn't waste time. Yaakov was somebody who had a goal in mind and worked towards it. And therefore, the time went by quickly because every day he was grabbing the moments. He was seizing the day to accomplish his goals. And when we have those feelings, it's not enough time in my day. I have so much to do, not enough time in my day. So that's a good feeling because that means you're productive. You have lots you have to take care of. When you feel there's just so much time here, nothing to fill it with, that's a bad thing because then that time's not being used productively. So you always want to be able to reach that point where my time is filled and it's moving too quickly for me. I mean, that can be stressful sometimes, but ultimately it shows that you're using your time productively. That time is being filled with things you have to do, which are accomplishments. And therefore, that time moves quickly in such a thing, in such a situation. So that is verse 20. Let's go to verse 21. So Yaakov said to Lavan, deliver my wife from my term is fulfilled, and I will consort with her. So we are now, 7 years has passed. Yaakov is working towards his goal. He reaches his goal. He says, time has come. And he has to ask for it. I mean, Lavan is somebody who is, like you said, a con artist. He's not forthcoming. He has to just offer Yaakov, okay, time is up. Here's your payments. Here's your wife. He has to be prodded. Okay, so he goes to the boss and says, boss, we had a deal. 7 years has passed. Where's my wife? So verse 22. So Lavan gathered all the people of the place and made a feast. So he says, oh, okay, it's time to make a wedding. So he called together all of his friends living in his area to make the celebration. The commentaries point out the fact he gathered them together, the idea of vayeso, they gathered together, it has an implication that he met with them beforehand. I mean, Lavan is planning to make a very big trick over here. He's planning to fool Yaakov. So how is he going to do that if nobody else is in on his plan? If everybody at the wedding knows they're supposed to marry Rachel, somebody's going to spot it's not Rachel. Someone's going to spill the beans in some way. So Yaakov, so Lavan, before the wedding, he gathers together everybody to work out the plan, to plot and scheme against Yaakov. And then he makes what the Torah calls a mishta. So mishta we translate as a feast or a party. Literally mishta is drinking, from the word like shoteh, drink. And the idea is that it was a drinking party. There was alcohol. We don't find him making a party like this when Yaakov marries Rachel later on. We only find it the first time. Why is that? Because Lavan wanted Yaakov drunk. Why do you want him drunk? So he could eat more easily, trick him. So if he figured if I give him a lot of alcohol, then he won't notice what's happening. So they made a drinking party in order so the trick could be carried on. So that is verse 22. Now verse 23, and it was in the evening, they took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him, and he consorted with her. Verse 24, and Lavan gave her Zilpah, his maidservant, a maidservant to Leah, his daughter. So the verse 23 describes the trick. Instead of Rachel being the one to marry Yaakov, it was Leah. And you know, we do wonder, I mean, how was Yaakov tricked? How did he not notice? That's always the question. Like, how can I notice the woman that you're actually marrying? So there are a lot of points. We'll talk more about this momentarily. But just to focus on this verse for one moment, the verse says that it was the evening, and he took Leah, his daughter. Lavan took Leah and brought Leah to Yaakov. So there's an implication here that Leah did not want to be involved in this trick at all. She was forced by her father. So she didn't go to Yaakov. She didn't just walk happily to the chuppah. She had to be taken by Lavan to be given to Yaakov. So Leah wasn't all in on this plan either. It sounds like, you know, she gave in, or maybe she had no choice, but she wasn't all in on it. So she was brought to Yaakov by Lavan, and she was forced into the trick. Now, verse 24 is very random. It says in verse 24 that Lavan gave her Zilpah, his maidservant, a maidservant to Leah, his daughter. And then verse 25 talks more about the marriage. So why is the Torah tossing in the fact that at the wedding it happened to be that Leah was given a maidservant named Zilpah? So the rabbis teach us this is all part of the trick as well. Why? Because there were two maidservants. There was Bilhah and there was Zilpah. Bilhah was older and Zilpah was younger. So logically, everybody thought, well, Leah was older, then she should get the older maidservant. So she should get Bilhah. And Rachel was younger, she should get the younger maidservant, which was Zilpah. So why is it that it was switched and Lavan gave Zilpah to Leah and Bilhah to Rachel? The older one to the younger one, the younger one to the older one. So that was all part of the trick. Because as everybody saw, oh, look who's with her, it's Zilpah, they figured that makes sense because it's Rachel. So this is all, you know, Lavan was creating a sort of an ambiance that nobody would question what's going on over here because he wanted to pull off this trick. So therefore, Lavan, it says right now in the middle of the story that he gave Zilpah to Leah because that was part of the trick. That trick was that they would see Zilpah and assume that must be Rachel's maidservant. Now let's look at verse 25. And it was in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. So Yaakov, until the morning, did not know who it was. Just simply, in the days before electric lighting, nighttime was very dark. It was very dark. And we know that, you know, as we understand the custom of wearing a veil, she was covered at the wedding. And then it was very dark all night long. And he didn't know who it was. And then the morning, it was Leah. So he said to Lavan, what is this that you've done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I worked for you? Why have you deceived me? So we have here the trick being pulled off. And let's understand a little bit of how this worked. And it's hard for us to understand. I mean, to be married to the wrong person, not notice something that kind of, you know, we don't really get how that works, which I don't know if we'll have a full understanding of Yaakov's relationship with his wives and how he couldn't notice. We're talking about a different world and a different type of person. But the rabbis tell us the following point. The rabbis say that, and this is a very famous idea, that Yaakov was suspicious of Lavan. He knew that Lavan was a tricky, you know, cheating con artist and may try to pull off a trick like this. So he made a system of codes with Rachel so that in the nighttime, when they were together, he'd be able to use this code and prove it was Rachel. That's the rabbis tell us. So during the nighttime, he went through the codes, these symbols, whatever they made up together, the code, the password, and the woman who was with him said the right things. So he figured, okay, I can't see her, but this must be Rachel because she knows the password. She knows the code. What actually happened, though, was that Rachel, when she saw that this trick was going to occur, she was concerned for her sister. She was concerned that what happens if it's the middle of the night and she's caught? She's going to be so ashamed of herself. It's going to be such an embarrassment. Yaakov might pick her up and throw her out, and everyone's going to see it. It's going to be horrible. So Rachel passed on these signs, this code, this password to Leah, and she knew the password. Now, one commentary points out, just putting that aside for a second, now Yaakov's getting a taste of his own medicine because Yaakov did the same thing to his father. Now, years back, we learned about this more recently. Now, Yaakov went in to steal the brachos from his father and tricked his father, and he posed as Esav. So the same way that Yaakov posed as Esav, his brother, and tricked his father, so too, Leah posed as Rachel, her sister, and tricked Yaakov. So, you know, Yaakov's not a stranger to this deception. Now, we would say in the big picture, the deception of Yaakov to his father was the right thing at the end. That was prophecy from his mother, Rivka. This deception was Lavan's scheme, but ultimately Yaakov is going to taste his own medicine because Yaakov posed as his own brother, and Rachel and Leah is posing as her sister. But this story, you know, Rachel with her compassion saw her sister in a compromised situation. She understood if she is caught, then she's going to be embarrassed and ashamed. That's to preserve her dignity. So she passed on this system of passwords or codes to Leah. So Leah wasn't caught until the morning when it was noticed. But in the morning already, at that point, you know, Yaakov would be able to, you know, not toss her out on the spot. And they'd have to, that morning, they're able to figure it out in a way that did not shame her. So this story is looked at by the rabbis, by the sages, as an incredible act of selflessness on behalf of Rachel. It's a very famous thing. And let's just picture, often you have to take these stories and just try to put it into simple terms to understand why it was so selfless. You know, Rachel Imenu, she was somebody who, as we spoke about before, was destined to marry Yaakov from the start. Leah was supposed to marry Esav and Rachel to Yaakov. Rachel's been waiting to marry Yaakov as well for 7 years. Rachel's excited about it. They've built a relationship. We said Yaakov spent his time building himself up and building that relationship. So she's very excited for this marriage. She understands how holy, how pure, how honest, how lofty Yaakov is. She understands the quality of a husband that she's getting. And she understands the dream of building up the Jewish people. The rabbis tell us that Rachel only understood that they were here for a purpose, which is to have the 12 tribes. They understood that. So Rachel said, I'm going to be the mother, you know, just like Sarah and Rivka, I'm going to be the next mother of Klal Yisrael. I'm going to be the one to build up the 12 tribes. She understood that. And that was her dream, that was her destiny, and that was her goal. And now her father comes in with this nasty trick and says, sorry, it's not going to happen. And she's crushed. She's crushed. She has no way to stop it. But her dreams are being crushed in front of her eyes. Now she has two choices now. She can be stuck, possibly without marrying Yaakov or even marrying Esav. You know, for all they know, if Leah marries Yaakov, maybe she'll be given over to Esav. What does she know? Esav of Russia, the terrible, wicked Esav. Or at least, if it's not Esav, her dreams and her destiny are going to be shattered. It's lost. She won't be a mother of Klal Yisrael. She's lost the opportunity. She could have stepped up and foiled the plan, you know, said, no, here I am. I'm Rachel. That's Leah. Stopped her in her tracks. Leah would have been ashamed. Love would be exposed. Would Yaakov marry Rachel? Maybe, probably even. You know, you would think at that point, Yaakov would probably marry Rachel. But she wasn't going to do that in a situation where she embarrassed her sister. She says, I'm not willing, even though my dreams are totally crushed, my destiny is now going to be brought into question. I'm not willing to embarrass my sister. I can't attack her dignity. I'm going to remain quiet, and I'm going to give her my password. That's what Rachel said. The rabbis tell us Rachel chose the plach shtika. She was silent. She remained silent. That was a tremendous act of selflessness, of self-sacrifice, on behalf of her sister's dignity, not to embarrass her sister. And that was her greatness. Now the rabbis tell us that it's better to be tossed into a fiery furnace rather than to embarrass somebody publicly. And Rachel understood that. And Rachel understood that I should avoid any proactive embarrassment or even just to remain passive and not give her the password, not to give her the code system, that also caused embarrassment. So certainly she didn't want to proactively step up and say, no, I'm Rachel, that's Leah, and stop the wedding. But she even said, I'm not going to let her be ashamed, even passively. I'm going to proactively give her my password, give her the code, so that they can make it through the night without her being embarrassed. And that was Rachel's greatness, because she said, the shame of my sister is worth more than anything else. Somebody else's dignity, somebody else's honor is primary to Rachel. Another point made is that Rachel understood, if I'm going to be the mother of the Jewish people, we can't be based on somebody else's pain. Like let's just maybe discuss the scenario. Let's say Rachel got up at the wedding and she said, no, I'm Rachel, that's Leah, stop the ceremony, right? And everyone would be like, it would be quite a scene. And then Yaakov takes Rachel and they run off and they get married, they elope somewhere else and they build up Klal Yisrael. Imagine that scene. What would happen there? That would mean, okay, so maybe he'd marry Rachel. Maybe they give birth to the 12 tribes. But that means that the Jewish people are built up on someone's shame and embarrassment. You know, the foundation of who we are would be built up on Leah's embarrassment, Leah's shame. And Rachel understood you can't build God's holy people on top of somebody else's pain. It's impossible. We're people in the world are supposed to be sensitive to others. We're there to help others and to help ease their pain. We want to bring honor to God and honor to the Torah. And to say that our basis, our foundation, is Leah's pain and anguish and shame is impossible to do. And Rachel got that. She understood that. So she said, what benefit will there be in me stopping this sham, you know, this trick? So my sister will be embarrassed. I'll get married. My marriage is built upon somebody else's pain. And where does that leave the Jewish people? Where does that leave God's goals? Leaves them nowhere. So Rachel then said, I'm going to remain passive. I'm not going to step up and foil the plot. And beyond that, I'm going to pass on the password to my sister so that she's not embarrassed at the moment. So that was Rachel's internal decision, which she made, which was considered by the rabbis one for history. You know, it was a decision which held her up in such high esteem in the history of Klal Yisrael as one of the greatest people to ever be part of the Jewish nation. And that those moments of that selflessness, that self-sacrifice, that's the foundation of Klal Yisrael. I mean, instead of Leah's pain, it's Rachel's self-sacrifice and selflessness that become our foundation, which is a beautiful thing. There's two different midrashim which kind of build on this point and bring out the importance of this moment. One medrash, they're both somewhat well known. One medrash addresses the following point. Now, Rachel dies before Leah, and Rachel is buried on the road on the way back to Eretz Yisrael. As we know, those who've been there, Kever Rachel, Rachel is not buried in Hebron with the other Avos Nimahos. Rachel is buried in Beis Lechem, which was on the road entering into Eretz Yisrael on Yaakov's way back. So what's the idea of being buried on the road? So the rabbis tell us, Rashi quotes it, it's a medrash, that Hashem wanted to have Rachel buried on the road. Why? Because we know that at some point the Jews would go to exile. And having Rachel buried there on the road, watching her children, as it were, from the grave, being led out to exile by the Babylonians, she'd be there to cry and daven on our behalf. Meaning the Jews walked by Kever Rachel on their way into Babylonia. When they were exiled at the destruction of the first temple, they walked by Kever Rachel on their way out to exile. And Rachel would be there, and her tears, her cries would stand on our behalf and help us, you know, get past the terrible plight of exile and be brought back to Eretz Yisrael. These are verses in the book of Yirmiyah, of Jeremiah, which we actually read in Rosh Hashanah, in the Haftorah. It's made into many famous songs. Rachel Mavakel, but yeah, Rachel cries for her children. And Hashem comes to Rachel and says, you can stop crying. I've heard your cries. I've heard your tears. And I'll bring them back. They have hope. There's a hope for your future. I will bring them back to their borders. So it's the merit of Rachel's tears and Rachel's prayers up in the heavens that help bring back the Jewish people to Eretz Yisrael. That's one medrash. An important point here is that, what do we see? We see the cry of a mother. No, Rachel's our mother. And the tears of Rachel are very powerful. Why? Because the rabbis teach us a mother's cries are very powerful. We understand when we make a mishaberech for somebody who's sick, so we use their mother's name, not their father's name. Why? Because we say the mother's name evokes more divine mercy than a father's name. Women, I think you were a mother for her child, can bring out that mercy from Shemayim. Who has more compassion in the world than a mother and a child? Most compassionate relationship you have in the world is the mother's care and compassion for her children. So Rachel, who's the mother of the Jewish people, when she cries for us, those tears and that crying is the most valuable. It's the most powerful. The same way when a mother davens for her children, those tears and that compassion is really powerful. So that's one medrash. And this evokes the extra rachman, the extra mercy from Hashem, which helps us in Golos, in exile, and helps bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. There's a second medrash, very similar, built on the same point, that speaks about some of the bad times when we were in Eretz Yisrael, when we had kings who brought idols into the Beis HaMikdash. We had some wicked kings out there, if you read through Tanakh, who spread Avodah Zarah, idolatry, throughout the land of Israel, and even brought idols into the Beis HaMikdash itself. So the Medrash speaks about how when this happened, obviously Hashem gets very upset, and he goes to all the avos, the patriarchs, the matriarchs, and he wants an explanation. He wants an excuse. He wants some reason to show compassion. And the only one that has a real excuse or a real claim to Hashem is Rachel. Because Rachel says, wait a minute, Hashem, who has more mercy, the human being or God? She said, when my sister went in to marry Yaakov, I showed compassion upon her. Even though we look at a relationship, if somebody, let's say, we understand the relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people as like a marriage. And if somebody has an extramarital affair, so that's similar to idolatry, because we're leaving God and we're going to an idol. Like a woman, like a husband or a wife leaving their spouse and going to have an extramarital affair. That's how we view it. And when my destiny, my destined husband, Yaakov, ended up with my sister, I had compassion upon my sister, even though she was taking my husband, and I helped her out, and I preserved her dignity. So when the Jews are leaving Hashem and going to another husband, as it were, to idols, do you have less compassion than me? If a human being can be so compassionate, then why not you, Hashem? That was Rachel's claim, Rachel's conversation, or I guess I don't want to say attack, but plea to God that if I can be so compassionate, then why not you? And then God heard those prayers and showed compassion. So that's another medrash. So Rachel stands for Klal Yisrael based on this incredible feat of selflessness as a fountain of compassion, as somebody who evokes God's compassion upon us at all times, because she showed so much compassion and care and preserved her sister's dignity and gave up all she had for her sister. So those tears and that mercy stands in our behalf as well. And there's a famous story of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva. He was somebody who was saved going through Shanghai during World War II, ended up in Eretz Yisrael, and he was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir. So Rav Chaim used to go monthly to Kever Rachel and Davin. He would say the following. It says in the book of Yirmiyah that Rachel cries for her people, for her children. Rachel Mavakal Beneha. Hashem tells Rachel, hold back your tears. I've heard your prayers. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz would say, Hashem, Rachel, he would say, Mama Rachel. He would say, Hashem tells you to hold back your tears. But I'm telling you, keep on crying for us. Keep on crying. We need those tears. And he would plead with Rachel Imenu that she should keep on crying for us until we're restored back to Eretz Yisrael with Nubias and Mikdash. And we still hope those tears would still stand on our behalf. So it was a plea that those tears should keep on coming. Because why? Because those tears help us. And if Rachel has compassion upon her children, then Hashem shows compassion to us as well. So this is the greatness of Rachel Imenu. And this is what we still, this act was so selfless and so powerful, we still benefit from it to this very day. The benefit of that act stands for us at all difficult times. Now, verse 25, so Yaakov is obviously surprised. He finds out that he actually married Leah, not Rachel. And he goes to Laban and confronts him and says, what have you done to me? I work for Rachel, not for Leah. You've deceived me. So the Rav Volba points out the following point. You would think Yaakov would be very angry. That's what you would think. But the Torah does not tell us Yaakov got angry. Usually if someone gets angry, the Torah says, Yichar af. He got angry. Yichar af Yaakov. Yichar af Moshe. Yichar af Hashem. The Torah does not mention anger. The Torah says he confronted him and he questioned him. Because why? Yaakov doesn't get angry. Yaakov complains, but he didn't let it. Yaakov has had so much self-control. He didn't let that, he didn't lose his temper. Like most of us in a situation like that would have lost it. We would have gone after Laban with a knife or something. I don't know what we would have done. But Yaakov is composed. He has self-control. Doesn't lose it. He confronts him. He says, this is wrong. You've wronged me. You've deceived me. But yet he does not lose his temper to his uncle. It's a very important point to understand the greatness of the human being, that somebody in a situation like that could still have self-control and remain composed. And most of us in much less trying situations would lose our temper. Yaakov, 7 years is a long time. 7 years of work, and then the boss says, sorry, you know, I offered you this sour, give me something else. I mean, we would be quite upset. So Yaakov, again, he confronts him, doesn't lose his temper. Now, Laban, verse 26, he says, well, I have an excuse. Laban says, such not done in our place, to give the younger before the elder. In our place, we don't do that. You want me to go against societal norms. In our society, we always have the older daughter get married first. Rachel's younger, Leah's still single. So that's why I did it. So what's Laban doing? It's very interesting. Even people who are deceptive con artists, they can excuse themselves as well. No, nobody, no one wants to admit I'm a liar and cheater. Nobody, even the most hardened criminals, they can justify their actions. They say, you know, on death row, nobody's guilty. You know, you go to all of them, they all have their excuses. They all do. So Laban, who clearly deceived, who clearly tricked Yaakov, he says, no, I was in the moral right. What you're doing is immoral, because you want me to go against the norm of society and give my younger daughter first? That's not how it's done around here, Yaakov. I'm sorry, we maybe had a deal, but I'm sticking to the ethics of our locale, and you're going against it. So Laban's not willing to admit that he's a cheater or a liar. He has his excuse, and he probably believed it too. Again, most people who do things like this, deep down, they may know they're wrong, but on the surface, they can excuse it. And they give this with rationale, and they justify it, and they start believing it too. And they believe their story. Now, everybody deep down, you know, might have a sense, or maybe I did something wrong, but they can always, you know, on the surface, ignore that feeling, justify the action, and Laban did the same. So in verse 27, Laban says, complete the week of this one, and we'll give you the other one too, for the work which you will perform for me another 7 years. So at that point, Laban tells Yaakov, okay, you know, what I did is right. It was totally fine for me to give you Leah. That's just how it's done around here. I'm sorry. That's how people do it. So let's make another deal. Let's finish this week. This week means Sheva Brachos. It's the commentaries say, even in those days, there was a common custom to make a week of celebration, like Sheva Brachos, like we would have. So let's finish the week of celebrating your first marriage. And then I'll give you Rachel for another 7 years. So here it was different, actually, because he would marry Rachel first and then work 7 years. Meaning for the first marriage, he had to work 7 years and then get married. But now he could take the wife first and then give 7 years. And in this way, he would be sure that he got what he needed before he could put all that work into Laban's farm. So that's the deal they make for another 7 years of work. And if you look at the wording, verse 27, it says, we will give you the other. Who's the we? I mean, the person involved here is Laban. It should say, I will give it to you. Why does it say we? So some commentaries say that Laban is still blaming the people of the city. He says that I can't do anything if they don't agree to it. People of the city are going to riot if I gave you my younger daughter first, because that's not what's done around here. So I couldn't do that. But they will then agree if I give you Rachel now, because we've gone in the right order. So he's still blaming everybody else for his actions. Other commentaries say that the idea of we will give you Rachel is that Yaakov now is bringing in the people of the town to watch what's happening and to be sure they're in on the deal. I mean, Yaakov says, I don't want to be tricked again. So if I can get assurance from the entire town that I really marry Rachel, I'll do this deal. But until I get their assurance, I'm not doing the deal. So we will give, it could mean that Yaakov brought in the entire townspeople and had them sit down and say, okay, everybody, I'm going to marry Rachel for 7 years. Everyone agrees to that. Everyone's on board. Everyone could testify this is the deal. And once the entire town agreed, then he said, okay. So either it's Laban blaming the town or it's Yaakov needing their assurance. So what happens next? So Yaakov did so, verse 28. He completed the week for her. He gave him Rachel, his daughter, to him as a wife. Okay, so the week of celebration, Sheva Brachos of Yaakov and Leah finished. Yaakov married Rachel. And then he goes ahead to begin working for the next 7 years. So I want to pause there and discuss a very important point. It's a point that many commentaries focus on. And it's something that, it's a question we should all have. It's a known thing, there's sources for it, that even though we're talking about prior to Torah being given, the Avos Imos kept the Torah. So the Torah wasn't given until we came to Mount Sinai after leaving Egypt. And the obligation of keeping the Torah did not occur until then. We became obligated only at Har Sinai, and then that's going to be a few hundred years after this incident. However, the verse tells us earlier that Avraham listened to Hashem's voice. Vishma Mishmarti, Mitzvosai Chukosev Sarosa. That Abraham kept Hashem's mitzvos, his laws, his Torah. The Mishnah tells us that the Avos kept all the mitzvos. So we assume the Avos kept the mitzvos, even though they didn't have the Torah yet. Like they didn't have the revelation, Har Sinai yet. They knew the Torah and kept the Torah. If that's the case, we have a big problem. Because Yaakov is married to two sisters. One of the marital prohibitions of the Torah is you can't marry two sisters. That's considered a grave act of arias, of illicit relationships. It's considered one of a very serious sin to marry two sisters. It's incestual. That's how we view it. So why was it okay for Yaakov to marry two sisters? Why was it, if Yaakov, meaning you could say, well, the Torah wasn't given yet. But we have so many sources to tell us that the Avos kept the Torah. So there has to be some reason why Yaakov could marry two sisters. Why was that okay? And commentaries have a lot of answers to this question because it's a real question. How could it be that he married two sisters? So I want to maybe just run through a few answers to this question, but it's an important question. So one answer is given by one of the commentaries called the Radbaz. The Radbaz says, well, let's analyze the question for a second. Is what he's doing really prohibited? So this is very simply the following. Let's picture a modern day scenario. You have a family of non-Jews and there's two sisters that convert to Judaism, right? So you have a family, they're brought up non-Jewish and two of the girls convert. So can you marry the two, could a man marry the two sisters or not? Now, again, we only marry one wife. Now we're into, only we don't have any polygamous relationships anymore. But in the days where a man can marry more than one wife, could he marry those two sisters? That's the question. Or alternatively, let's say he divorces one, can marry the other. That'd be the question. So halachically, if the two are converts, they're not considered sisters halachically, which would mean that technically you could marry both of them. So if we were to analyze the case over here, Rachel and Leah were not brought up as Jews, they're brought up as idolaters. And they, quote unquote, as it were, converted to Judaism. They both became converts. So technically, halachically, they're not really considered sisters because they converted. We say a ger shizgar kekat shenola dami. When somebody converts, they're like they're reborn, and the relationship halachically with their family is not there anymore with their non-Jewish family. There might be some obligations to honor their parents still, etc. But ultimately, that relationship is not recognized halachically. Now they're Jews. They have a new relationship. They're like reborn. They're new. They're refreshed. So technically, Rachel and Leah weren't really halachic sisters once they converted to Judaism. So that's one answer given. The question you'd have is that, well, there wasn't really Jews at the time, and you couldn't really convert either. So it's hard to view that as a conversion, because the Avos, even though they may have kept the Torah, they weren't officially Jews until Mount Sinai. There was no Jewish people. It was a little different back then. But that's one answer given. The Ramban, Nachmanides, says a different answer. He says, when we say that the Avos kept the Torah, that was only in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, they kept it, but not when they were outside Eretz Yisrael, not when they were chutzlars, not in the diaspora. So therefore, if you look at the way the Torah describes the story of Rachel and Leah, Yaakov married Rachel, he was outside Eretz Yisrael. She dies immediately upon reentry. When he goes back to Eretz Yisrael, years later, we're talking now about I think 15 years after this. So when they go back to her Israel, she dies just about immediately. Because the Ramban says the Avos kept the Torah to Israel, not in Chutz Laretz. Now, why would that be? We know we're obligated just as much to keep mitzvos in America as we are in Israel. We're not, there's no lesser obligation. But the Ramban says a very interesting point. The Ramban says that even though one is obligated to keep the mitzvos in America as well, in Chutz Laretz, outside of Israel. We look at this kind of, I don't want to say as practice, but it's not the ideal. It's not the real deal. I mean, the Torah was given to be observed and kept by Jews in the land of Israel. The effect of a mitzvah in the land of Israel is more powerful. The outcome of a sin is more powerful. The connection that you make to God through keeping Torah in Eretz Yisrael is more powerful. And that's the ideal place to observe Torah. In Chutz Laaretz, we have to keep the mitzvos. We have to follow the Torah. But it's not the ideal place, and you don't make, it's not the ideal connection to Torah that should be. So the Avos and Imos understood this. And they said, you know, we are choosing to keep Torah. We're not obligated, we're choosing to do so. So where we choose to do so in Eretz Yisrael, where it's the ideal place to actually keep the mitzvos. Doing it in outside of Israel is kind of like a placeholder. It's less than ideal until we get back to the land. So when they left Eretz Yisrael, they didn't keep all the mitzvos, but in Eretz Yisrael, they kept them all. So Yaakov marries two sisters when he's still in the land of Haran, where he's away from Eretz Yisrael. And since the Torah there is not being kept in the ideal sense, Yaakov has a reason, whatever reason it is, to marry two sisters. Once he goes back to Eretz Yisrael, Rachel dies. In Eretz Yisrael, the Avos all kept the mitzvos. So that's what the Ramban says. The message to us is the following. I mean, number one, we have to understand we are obligated in America just as much as in Israel mitzvos. We're not questioning the obligation outside of Israel. But it's the power of the obligation. The Torah was given to be observed in the land of Israel. That's the ultimate place for a Jew and the ultimate goal of the Torah. But that being said, the power of a mitzvah in Israel is much greater than the power of a mitzvah in America. And the grave results or consequences of an aveir in Israel are much more consequential than in America as well. It goes both ways. That's what Torah says, the land will spit you out if you're doing aveiros. If you're sinning in Eretz Yisrael, it says the land spits you out. That's not true outside of Israel because the land's not as sensitive. It's not as spiritually, it's not as in line with your actions when you're in America as is in Israel. So the Avos understood the place to keep Torah ideally is in Israel, so we'll keep it there. When they were outside of Israel, so they could choose not to. Now we have to keep it regardless because we're living post Mount Sinai. Post Mount Sinai, the Torah is an obligation, it's mandatory, and you can't pick and choose what you want to do. Prior to Mount Sinai, the Torah wasn't obligatory, so therefore they could choose what they want to do. So that's the Ramban. The Or HaChaim, he says another answer. He says that being that they were before the Torah was given, the Avos Imos would keep the Torah unless they had reason otherwise. Meaning that nowadays we can't choose when to or when not to keep the Torah. We have to do it because it's an obligation upon us. It's not up to us to decide, well, today I think I have a reason to eat a cheeseburger, so I'll eat the cheeseburger today, and tomorrow I have a reason not to eat the cheeseburger, I won't do it. We can't do that. But the Avos Imos, if they understood that violating the Torah would bring to some sort of benefit, again, based on their lofty calculations, they would do it. And there's a few examples of this. But they were allowed to because it was prior to Mount Sinai. So they can make that calculation and say, I feel there is a great benefit in marrying Rachel and Leah. And therefore, I'm going to do it, even though it's against the Torah, because I'm not obligated yet. The Torah wasn't given yet. Like a non-Jew. A non-Jew nowadays, they could opt to keep a mitzvah, and it's a nice thing, but they don't have to. And if they decide not to, that's also fine. So a non-Jew might say, well, I really think it's meaningful how the Jews blow shofar. I'll do it too. We'll say, fine, go ahead. Not a problem. They're allowed to, and they can gain from it. But if he says one day, you know, I don't feel like it, we say, that's fine too. You're not obligated. As a Jew, we're obligated to blow shofar, and we can't just opt out because it's an obligation. So the Avos were able to opt in when they felt it was good for them and opt out when they felt it wasn't good. Now, just I don't want to oversimplify it because we're talking here about very big, complex spiritual calculations they were making. They didn't just say, like, I'm not in the mood today, I'm going to have a cheeseburger. They would have to be able to, they would have real spiritual reasons why not to keep the Torah, such as Yaakov understood Rachel and Leah were the right match for him, as we spoke a few weeks ago, and how the two of them combined would create, you know, the 12 tribes. So Yaakov had a deep spiritual reason why he felt he should marry Rachel and Leah, but it was okay because it was prior to the Torah being given. There's one more quick answer. I'll end with this. The Radbaz quotes from in a very early commentary, the Rashba, and he says the following more Kabbalistic point. He says that just like we understand that some mitzvos are only done at certain times, meaning you only keep Shabbos on Shabbos. You don't keep Shabbos on Tuesday. You only keep Pesach on Pesach. You don't keep Pesach in October. You don't do that. And some mitzvahs are confined to places, meaning some mitzvahs are only done in Israel or in the Beis HaMikdash and not elsewhere. And some mitzvahs are only done by certain people. No, only Kohanim can do certain things that the Yisrael can't do. There's mitzvahs that men do, women don't do. There's mitzvahs that kings do that non-kings don't do. So he says that Kabbalistically, Yaakov was a person that this was a mitzvah that didn't apply to him. Kabbalistically, there was something about Yaakov's soul that marrying two sisters was not a problem to do. Just like, you know, for a Kohen to offer a sacrifice, that's a mitzvah. For me to do it, I'm not a Kohen, that would be a sin. To keep Shabbos on Saturday is a mitzvah. To keep Shabbos on Wednesday is meaningless. So for most of us, keeping to the prohibition of two sisters is meaningful. For Yaakov, it wasn't a thing. Now, why not? This is some sort of Kabbalistic idea of a Yaakov's soul didn't have a problem with two sisters. That much I don't know. But that's how he explains it. So again, for us, it doesn't mean that we can do soul searching and figure out which mitzvahs don't apply to us. And we're post Mount Sinai, so it's all obligations, and we don't get involved in spirituality like that. We don't do those types of things. But prior to Mount Sinai, that could be done. So prior to Mount Sinai, it was understood that Yaakov's soul didn't have any issue with marrying two sisters, and it could be done that way. Again, post Mount Sinai, it can be done that way, because once it's the obligation is there, the obligation remains. So that's another answer, more Kabbalistic, more mystical, why Yaakov can marry two sisters. There's a lot of different approaches to the issue, but ultimately, I think the key to it is that it was prior to the Torah being given to Mount Sinai, and therefore it wasn't an obligation. So if there was some convincing idea, rationale, calculation, why to do the sin, it was okay, because it wasn't an obligation upon them at the time. So it's an interesting side note as to how you can marry two sisters. Okay, well, we'll stop there for the week.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
Be well. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good
how's
week.
How's your family doing? Rabbi, how's your family doing?
Everyone's great, thank God.
Yeah.
Baby, she's growing fast.
That's great.
She's about 6 weeks old now, but gained a few pounds.
Wow.
A little chubby. She's cute. Yeah. She's doing great.
Are you at Shoresh?
I'm at Shoresh right now. Yeah.
I can see by the pictures.
Oh, do you know you've been here before?
My grandchildren all went.
Uh huh. Okay, that's where I am every day this year. The yeshiva's moved there for the year.
Yeah, my grandchildren.
Yeah, it looks like an amazing camp. Looks really fun.
The Rosenblum's children from Baltimore.
Uh-huh. So nice. It looks like a great camp. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I know.
Beautiful grounds.
Okay, take care.
Be well. Have a great week.